This spot is brought to you by Eaton Vance, the symbol of advanced investing. What's inside your ETF? With Eaton Vance High Yield ETF, you know. Inside, you'll find smart bond selection from a specialized team with deep fixed income expertise. Get to know what's inside EVHY, the symbol of high yield done right, at eatonvance.com/symbols. Before investing, prospective investors should carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. The current prospectus contains this and other information and is available at eatonvance.com. Read the prospectus carefully before investing. Not FDIC insured. Offer no bank guarantee. May lose value. Not insured by any federal government agency. Not a deposit. Investments involve risk. Principal loss is possible. Distributed by Foreside Fund Services, LLC.
The cost of natural gas soars as Chevron workers in Australia walk out. Plus, U.S. home prices pick up after falling for five straight months. And how Washington is pushing for unity at the G20 summit amid growing global tensions.
There are diverging interests between some of the Western and developing economies. One national security spokesman this week said that it's hard to make 20 clocks chime at the same time.
It's Friday, September 8th. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Natural gas prices have spiked this morning after news that workers at some of the world's largest natural gas plants are walking off the job. Talks between a union in Australia and energy giant Chevron collapsed today, and rolling work stoppages have already begun. The Journal's Rhiannon Hoyle is in Adelaide and told us that the threat of a full-blown strike beginning next week means more price shocks could now be in store.
These facilities account for roughly 7% of global LNG capacity. This is the reason why it's been creating so much volatility in gas prices in recent weeks and has been causing these sorts of spikes in prices, particularly in Europe. Now, gas in storage in Europe is high heading toward the winter season, which has provided a buffer of sorts to prices. But the market can't ignore the risk here, especially heading toward that Northern Hemisphere winter. A number of analysts who track the market closely aren't expecting a prolonged dispute. They feel that Chevron will need to resolve this sooner rather than later. But for sure, the dispute has highlighted Europe's dependence on LNG, which accounts for more than 40% of the gas it needs today, double what it did before the Ukraine war began.
Meanwhile, stock markets in Asia were down this morning, spurred in part by concerns over Apple's woes in China and how that would impact suppliers. That follows this week's Journal reporting that China has banned government employees from using iPhones. But there is more that's going on across the continent today, including the heaviest rain in more than 130 years flooding Hong Kong and forcing its stock exchange to cancel trading for the second time in a week. And in Japan, a revision to its GDP figures have shown growth in the second quarter was significantly less than the 6% expansion originally recorded. Peter Landers is our Tokyo bureau chief. Peter, GDP revisions are not altogether uncommon. So why then are we seeing a market reaction today? Is it because of that?
I would say it's not so much the GDP numbers. It's really the concern about increasing tensions between the U.S. and China, which affect a lot of Japanese companies that supply the tech industry in both countries, but especially in China. For example, Tokyo Electron, which is a big maker of semiconductor manufacturing equipment, was down 3.8% today. And the fear would be that they would be less able to export to China.
Just on the Japan GDP reading, though, Peter, as we talked about on the show just a few days ago, Japan had been seeing an influx of investments, which had propelled really strong growth there this year. What is the outlook now?
GDP growth in the second quarter, even after the revision, was an annualized 4.8%. So that's really good for Japan. And it was always expected that wouldn't be maintained for very long. The forecast for this year would be somewhere between 1% and 2%, maybe next year also between 1% and 2%. And that's about all Japan can expect over the long term with its population declining. So growth is likely to settle into somewhere in the 1% to 2%.
That was Journal Tokyo Bureau Chief Peter Landers. President Biden is expected to arrive in India today to attend the G20 summit, a gathering of the world's largest economies. The U.S. will be pushing for unity at the summit, but as the Journal's Catherine Lucy explains, deepening global rivalries are likely to overshadow this week's gathering.
This is a big moment for India hosting this event, and there's a lot of big issues, both the leaders of China and Russia sitting this one out, and the U.S. certainly go into this with a couple of key goals. One is they are going to continue to push for unity to counter Russia in their invasion of Ukraine, and for the countries to make a joint statement about the war in a communique or a declaration at the end of this summit is a priority. Another thing that we're going to hear from President Biden, and another key goal, is they want to talk about financing and funding for developing nations and how to strengthen the World Bank and other multinationals to better provide support to those countries.
Coming up, in a matter of years, Gulf countries have emerged as the world's ATM. We'll look at how the region's sovereign wealth funds came to throw around so much weight on the global stage, and how Western financiers are responding after the break.
This spot is brought to you by Eaton Vance, the symbol of advanced investing. What's inside your ETF? With Eaton Vance High Yield ETF, you know. Inside, you'll find smart bond selection from a specialized team with deep fixed income expertise. Get to know what's inside EVHY, the symbol of high yield done right, at eatonvance.com/symbols. Before investing, prospective investors should carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. The current prospectus contains this and other information and is available at eatonvance.com. Read the prospectus carefully before investing. Not FDIC insured. Offer no bank guarantee. May lose value. Not insured by any federal government agency. Not a deposit. Investments involve risk. Principal loss is possible. Distributed by Foreside Fund Services, LLC.
Five years ago, American finance executives were pulling out of Saudi Arabia's giant investment confab, nicknamed Davos in the Desert. But now, with the latest future investment initiative kicking off early next month, they're trying to get back in, as the kingdom and other Middle East monarchies have their moment on the world's financial stage. And joining me now from Dubai with a look at how the Gulf has lately become something of the world's ATM, I'm joined by Wall Street Journal reporter Rory Jones. Rory, walk us through this, how we got to this present moment from where we were just a half decade ago.
I was at the Davos in the Desert conference 5 years ago, and it was a bit of an eerie, odd atmosphere because not long before, Saudi Arabia had been accused of murdering a journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, and lots of American and Western executives had pulled out of the conference. Fast forward now to this year, and the demand for capital from the Middle East and the Gulf countries is so high that the conference in Riyadh is charging executives $15,000 a pop to attend. And so that's illustrative of a shift, really, in global appetite for Gulf capital. The Gulf sovereign wealth funds have always been quite well capitalized and have had a lot of cash to spend. But there's now a greater interest in trying to get a little bit of that money from Western investors around the world.
Given that you mentioned these funds have been well-heeled for some time, I'm curious what makes them so appealing right now. Is it their location or the fact that other financiers have backed away, or maybe some combination of both?
Yeah, you're right. It's a combination of the both. So the Ukraine war last year caused an increase in hydrocarbon prices, in oil prices. Many of the countries here are oil producers or gas producers, and so their sovereign wealth funds are feeling a little flusher. But then at the same time, what we've seen as interest rates have risen around the world is there's been a greater caution among pension funds and other investors, traditional Western investors, to back asset managers and venture capital. And we've seen stock market prices fall. So that's also had an impact.
All right. On these well-capitalized funds, tell us specifically which entities we're talking about, which countries they're in, whether they're government-linked, and what opportunities they are pursuing around the world.
The big names that we're talking about are Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund, the Public Investment Fund, and Abu Dhabi sovereign wealth funds. They all have slightly different aims and goals in their investing, but one of the sort of main things that they're trying to do is they're trying to make a return like any investor, but they're also trying to help diversify their economies. So they're investing in companies that will help each of these economies move away from a dependence on oil. And so PIF, the Saudi fund, has been very high profile in investing in sports ventures. It bought a soccer team in the UK and has backed a big golf tour. Mubadala, the Abu Dhabi sovereign wealth fund, it's been buying up other financial asset managers, investment managers, and they've also been placing money with other asset managers. These funds that got cash themselves, they've been giving that to more traditional Western investors to deploy because they see that there's some expertise there. And so the PIF alone last year had about $50 billion worth of commitments to funds that are going to invest its cash for it. And that could be private equity, that could be venture capital. And that was up about $20 billion from a year before. So that's a big jump.
And is there another layer to this, Rory, to the aims of the entities that are pursuing these investments that makes this a bit of a geopolitical story as well?
These are not traditional investors like you might see in the West that are purely out for financial return. They are seeking a bunch of different goals with their cash. And one of them is they want to try to diversify their economy. And so they want to try to encourage businesses and foreign direct investment into their countries so that they have industries that are different to oil and gas. And so we've seen a huge amount of these, the asset managers and venture capital funds and hedge funds actually set up in the Gulf region over the last couple of years. And one of the reasons is because they're seeking capital, but they also know that the governments here want to try to deepen their own expertise in financial services and create hubs here. And so the governments are achieving one of their aims by investing overseas, if that makes sense.
That was the Wall Street Journal's Rory Jones in Dubai. Rory, thanks.
Thanks so much.
The SEC is probing billionaire Ryan Cohen's $120 million trades of shares in retailer Bed Bath & Beyond last year, a five-month investment that netted him a profit of nearly $60 million. Cohen has a fan base of individual investors, and his investment spurred a trading frenzy that saw Bed Bath & Beyond stock at one point soar 34% in a day, only for it to collapse when his surprise sale was announced. The SEC is said to have requested info from Cohen about his trades and communications with the company, and has sought records from some of its current and former board members. And while little is known beyond that, Journal reporter Ben Dummett told us this isn't the first time that Cohen's trades have come under scrutiny.
This move by the SEC comes at a time when Cohen was sued last year by a group of Bed Bath & Beyond investors. Those investors alleged that Cohen committed fraud, claiming he didn't disclose bad news about the company that he was aware of when he sold the shares. They also claim he engaged in a so-called pump and dump scheme, which left many small investors in the red. That case is proceeding. For his part, Cohen has denied he misled the market and says his sales were based on the company being overvalued after its stock rose.
After slipping for five consecutive months, U.S. home prices finally rose in July. The surprisingly quick recovery after the longest run of declines in 11 years is being driven in part by an unusually low inventory of homes for sale that have pushed the total value of U.S. homes to hit a new record in June, according to Redfin. Together, it suggests that the residential real estate downturn is turning out to be shorter and shallower than many housing economists had expected. And California has passed a first-in-the-nation state tax on firearms and ammunition. The bill now heads to the desk of California Governor Gavin Newsom. If signed, it would impose an 11% tax on all guns and ammunition sales, with the proceeds funding gun violence prevention and school safety programs. The bill exempts vendors with less than $5,000 in quarterly sales, as well as sales to law enforcement. The federal government already imposes a 10% tax on handguns and 11% on long guns and ammo, while some local jurisdictions, including Seattle, also have gun taxes. And finally, Britain's Queen Elizabeth died 1 year ago today, prompting a nationwide mourning and some concerns about her heir-in-waiting, the now King Charles III. But a year into his reign, our UK correspondent Max Colchester told us that Charles has proved to be unexpectedly popular.
Before he became king, many feared that Charles would be an interventionist monarch, someone who would ruffle feathers by expressing views and breaking that long-held British convention of royal neutrality. And in fact, what's happened is that Charles has kept a very low profile for the last year. He hasn't said anything outlandish, kept a sort of stiff upper lip during the Harry and Meghan Markle saga, and he hasn't really put a foot wrong. And we see that in recent YouGov polling numbers, which show that 62% of British people have a positive opinion of King Charles. And most importantly of all, the popularity of the monarchy has remained stable, which is good news for the royal franchise as it goes forward.
And that's What's News for Friday morning. Today's show was produced by Mohsen Ali. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. Otherwise, have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.